Hi, it's Drew Carrington, head of institutional DC at Franklin Templeton, here with an update on all the stuff that's going on both the legislative and regulatory side with respect to retirement plans in Washington. I'm joined by Michael Hadley, who's a partner at the law firm of Davis & Harmon in Washington, D.C. Michael, the last time we talked, we had just had the passage of the CARES Act, which had a number of components that affected retirement plans. Since that time, the DOL in particular has been very busy with new regulations and clarifications. We have a new head of EBSA, the Employee Benefit Security Administration, at the Department of Labor. Maybe we start there and then talk about some of the stuff that the DOL has been up to.
That's right. So Preston Rutledge, who was the Assistant Secretary of Labor in charge of really all retirement, has stepped down, effective at the end of May, and has been replaced on an acting basis by Gene Wilson, who was Preston's principal deputy assistant secretary and is now at the acting assistant secretary. We don't think it's likely that there will be a Senate nominee, a sort of a permanent nominee, to fill that position, and that's fairly common at the end of a president's term. But Gene Wilson is going to be overseeing a huge number of projects that have just been finished and are likely to be seen here in the last part of 2020.
So one of the other items that's been on the Department of Labor's radar for quite some time is the revamp of the fiduciary rule following the court overturned fiduciary rule proposed by the Obama administration, DOL. We have a proposed set of regulations. There's multiple parts to what they've issued there, trying to align it with the SEC's regulation best interest. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what's proposed and what the parts are of what they've proposed, and then what the process is from here.
Sure. So the Department of Labor sort of put out two things at once. The first thing they did was essentially implement the court's decision to overturn the Obama era rule by reverting the test for fiduciary status, what we call the five-part test, back to the way it was before 2016, and basically the way it's been since 1975. And therefore, what makes you a fiduciary when you provide advice, the types of activities, kind of go back to the way things were. That was largely procedural, not open for comment. It just happened. The other thing that the Department of Labor did was release a proposed exemption. And this exemption would be available to financial institutions that want to provide advice, want to step up to fiduciary status, and may have compensation structures that otherwise would be prohibited. Basically very similar at a high level to what Reg BI did. Reg BI was the SEC's attempt to say, yes, you can get paid for advice, but you need to meet a certain number of standards and impartial conduct standard. That proposed exemption is only needed if you're a fiduciary. It doesn't turn anybody into a fiduciary who isn't otherwise one. But it would say if you are providing advice, including in the context of a rollover, and you'd be turned into a fiduciary under the old rules, here's a series of steps that you can take in order to comply with the law. And as you said, Drew, I think it is fair to say the Department of Labor, at least in the proposal, did a pretty good job coordinating the types of procedures that would need to be put in place with what the SEC requires. Next steps from here, very short comment period, only 30 days. And I think the goal for the Department of Labor is to get something finalized before the end of the president's term. They're going to have to rush to do that, but it is possible. And then the idea would be there would be an alignment where if you were providing advice in connection with rollovers, whether it's in an IRA or in a plan, you'd comply with Reg BI or some similar state law, and you'd comply with this new exemption.
In addition, the Department of Labor has also issued a proposed rule or regulation regarding environmental, social, and governance factors, ESG factors, for the guidance for fiduciaries of ERISA plans. This has been a topic that the DOL has addressed on a number of occasions, dating all the way back to the Clinton administration. Now we have a proposed regulation. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what's in it, a little bit about the history, and what the process is for this regulation.
The Department of Labor has said over and over again that a fiduciary must always put the interest of the plan and its participants first and can't sacrifice returns for social goals. That really has not changed no matter who's in power. But there has been a ping-ponging back and forth in what we call sub-regulatory guidance on the edges. That is to say, to what extent might a fiduciary assume that ESG factors might make a difference in terms of the return of the investment, and to what extent you might take them into account as a tiebreaker. You got two equivalent investments. You might look to one that has an ESG flavor if to break a tie. What the Department of Labor has proposed here for the first time is actually write into regulatory rules a set of standards that should apply when a plan fiduciary, whether a manager of a DB plan or determining the lineup for a 401k plan, the extent to which you could consider ESG factors. Now, much of the proposal, I think, restates longstanding law that, you know, you've got to be loyal to the plan first, can't sacrifice returns. But the proposal would go farther than that. For example, it would impose significant new obligations on a fiduciary that wanted to offer an ESG fund in the plan's lineup, even if participants were looking for it. And the preamble to the proposal, I think, is being viewed by a lot of folks as being fairly negative to ESG investing. This is in part an outgrowth of the White House's executive order on energy policy. But it's the first time the Department of Labor has actually tried to write into regulations, which will make it harder for the next administration to change, write in some standards that should apply to the fiduciaries when they consider ESG investments. Again, much of it restates current law, but I think what has took folks a little bit by surprise is when you read the sort of the text and the explanation, how much the current Department of Labor seems to think that ESG factors really are not appropriate. And in fact, they even say they think it's very unlikely you'd even have a tiebreaker situation. Theoretically possible, but unlikely. And I think there's going to be a good amount of pushback from folks who believe in ESG investing to this proposal, particularly some of the rhetoric that's contained within it. This one also has a 30-day comment period, so very short, and I think the administration would like to get it finalized before the next inauguration.
And in addition to the language in the preamble, they also explicitly prohibited the use of ESG factors when you're thinking about the default investment alternative, which in some ways mirrors the language that we saw in their guidance letter about private equity, where they're really starting to treat the qualified default investments in defined contribution plans differently than other investments on the menu.
I wasn't surprised to see that in the proposal because the Trump administration had said something along those lines in 2018. But I think you're right that you're beginning to see from the Department of Labor that they view the QDIA, the default investment, as a really special investment. And that's not surprising, as much of the assets that are going into plans right now are being invested in the plan's QDIA, whether it's a target date fund or otherwise. But it's very interesting that they would actually prohibit the use of an ESG-themed fund as the QDIA. Apparently, even if the plan fiduciaries think that is the best fund taking into account all factors. And that's why I think this is going to be fairly controversial of a proposal and likely see a lot of pushback.
And because that's not enough stuff for us to think about, finally, the Department of Labor sent over yet another proposed regulation. This one on the back of the SECURE Act, they were required to issue guidance around the lifetime income disclosure aspect of the SECURE Act. They send that over to OMB. In this instance, it's an interim final rule, which sounds like an oxymoron, but I wanted to get your thoughts on what do we think might be in there and what are the next steps on that?
Yes, the SECURE Act requires plans to at least once a year provide a lifetime income disclosure to participants, which takes their account balance and translates it into an estimated stream of income in retirement. The SECURE Act itself provides the Department of Labor a lot of flexibility to lay out the assumptions that should be used by a plan in creating that disclosure, although the SECURE Act does say it needs to be expressed in the form of a single life annuity and a joint life annuity with a spouse of the same age. The interim final rule is an interim final rule because the SECURE Act required DOL to do it that way. And it's sort of strange. Normally, interim final rules are used when you don't have time to get a notice and comment. for example, we have a COVID-19 pandemic and we have to change the rules for vaccines very quickly. Nonetheless, Congress said, we want you to do it that way. DOL will see comment on this interim final rule. And the reason they can do that is because the SECURE Act says that you don't actually have to start providing these disclosures as part of benefit statements until at least a year after the Department of Labor finalizes the rules. So while it's going to be called an interim final rule, they will see comment. And I think there's going to be no plan that's providing these disclosures now that won't have to change, because everybody does this slightly differently. We all acknowledge it's a good idea to give folks a chance to think about how much they've saved and what that really means in retirement income, and then maybe think about changing their contribution rate to increase that retirement income. But everybody does it differently. And I can guarantee that whatever the Department of Labor says, most folks are going to have to make some changes. And I think that'll be a period of adjustment. More to come. It's sort of amazing how many regulations we have out for comment right now. I think in all the years that I've been doing this, I can't remember having this many significant regulations out for comment at one time.
Well, so those are proposed regulations that are, we're waiting to see what's in those. So we can sort of imagine those in the queue. In the meantime, though, the Department of Labor did issue guidance on particularly with respect to e-delivery. And I know this has been a long-running topic for the industry. Maybe we could talk about sort of what's in it and what the implications are for plan sponsors, plan providers, plan participants.
The last time that the Department of Labor looked at the question of how can we communicate electronically with folks who participate in a 401k or other plan was 2002. And of course, things have changed quite a bit. This latest regulation enhances the ability of plan sponsors to provide documents required by ERISA electronically. And it does so through a pretty straightforward approach that most people will be pretty familiar with, called notice and access. Now, the way notice and access works is when a new regulatory document is required, your quarterly benefit statement, your summary plan description, something that the law requires be provided. Instead of sending somebody a lot of pieces of paper, instead, you would use an email or other electronic address that you have on file. You'd send them a notification that says, hey, a new and important document has been posted online in your account. Click here to log in and see a copy of it. But if you'd like to continue to receive that instead in paper, click here and we can accommodate that request as well. And so the idea is to move people to more to a default, where the default is that they're communicating with their plan electronically, getting regulatory documents electronically. And the goal there is not just to reduce cost, but also to enhance engagement. Because by getting somebody to kind of log in, not only look at whatever notice they have to get, but look at their savings rate, look at their diversification, we'll get better outcomes for participants. This e-delivery rule enshrines that there is a right to paper, and there will always be some people for whom there really is no email address and for whom they would still like to get paper. But it is a new set of options that providers will be looking at to kind of build and offer to plan sponsors. And I think if you're a plan sponsor, this would be something to ask your provider about. Hey, this is something that could work for me. When will you have it available?
And in light of the sort of the change in all of our working circumstances, the Department of Labor went ahead and moved up the effective date on that. I know it's a topic that they've been thinking about for a while, but made it applicable, I think, earlier than people anticipated.
That's right. Originally, they had proposed to not make it available until January 1 of 2021. But in response to comments, as well as directly in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, they said, if you're able to make this available to your plans and to your participants immediately, go ahead and do it.
And just so we're clear, this is actually a final regulation. This is the regulatory framework for default communication with plan participants, right?
That's right. This is a regulation. It's final. It's available as a separate safe harbor to the guidance that was issued from the Department of Labor in 2002. A plan sponsor can rely on it or not. They can rely on it for some of their population. And importantly, it's available even for folks that are no longer working, former employees as well as beneficiaries, if you have an email address for them that you can let them know you're going to communicate with them electronically. Again, everyone would always have the right to opt out to paper.
So speaking of electronic communication and being remote, I know that under the CARES Act, you know, one of the issues about taking a withdrawal from your 401k plan is in many instances you need notarized spousal approval for that withdrawal, and socially distant working from home context, those can be tricky. I know the IRS issued a little bit of guidance about remote notarization, not just with respect to the CARES Act, but more broadly. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and how that changes some of the dynamics in retirement plans as well.
So what you're talking about is a requirement that applies to some types of plans, but not all. It doesn't apply to a lot of 401k plans, but it does apply to some, certainly to pension plans and what are called money purchase plans. This is a requirement that before you take a loan or distribution, you generally have to get consent of your spouse. And that consent has to be witnessed by either a notary or by a plan representative. The IRS rules have always said that that needs to happen in the physical presence of the notary or the plan representative. Well, if there's one thing we know we're not supposed to do during the pandemic is be in each other's physical presence unnecessarily. And so the industry requested IRS to provide some sort of relief from that. While that was going on, lots of states were moving towards offering what's called remote notarization. And remote notarization means you get on a Zoom or Skype or FaceTime with a notary, and then you do all the things that you would have done in person, show them your ID, sign the document in front of them, et cetera, but you do it remotely. And lots of states have approved that on a permanent or temporary basis. What this IRS guidance says that is that at least for 2020, it's only temporary, so right now it's only available this year, a plan can allow spousal consent to be taken care of through remote notarization or through something similar that's offered by the plan representative, like somebody in HR. And this is directly and a very important response to this pandemic. It actually took them a while to get it done, in part because spousal consent is considered to be one of the most important protections, especially in defined benefit plans. You want to make sure that a spouse does not give up the right to income over their lifetime when a participant takes a lump sum. So it was important for them to make sure that they got it right. This is only available this year. I know there will probably be a push to extend it beyond 2020, in part because I think our lives are going to change even into next year, and as states make remote notarization more available.
So returning to the Department of Labor and their busy calendar, in addition to the proposed regulations and the final regulation, they also issued an information letter addressing the question of the use of private equity or illiquid private equity investments in a defined contribution plan. There's been a lot of talk about that letter. I'm wondering if maybe you could sort of set up kind of the background behind the letter and then what the letter is and is not in some ways. Again, it's just an information letter, not a regulation. So what does that mean for plan sponsors and their consultants and advisors?
As you say, an information letter is not really an official regulation. It's an expression of the Department of Labor's views on a topic, similar to an advisory opinion, but not necessarily addressing a particular set of facts. And it addresses the question of a plan, 401k or similar plan, that wants to offer as an investment some sort of asset allocation fund, say a target date fund or a balanced fund, which has different assets, classes within the investment, but would like to consider having one of those asset classes, a portion of the fund, be some sort of private equity. And while there are funds out there that already do that, there are plan sponsors that already do that, there's never actually been any guidance on the Department of Labor's views as to whether a fiduciary can allow that, and if so, what the fiduciary should think about. And this advisory opinion states what I think is pretty non-controversial, which is that ERISA doesn't impose on plan fiduciaries any particular rules as to what an asset allocation can or cannot invest in. Rather, ERISA's standard is prudence, and prudence depends on the facts and circumstances. And so the Department of Labor confirms that an asset allocation vehicle could have private equity if the fiduciary determines that it's prudent. The letter spends a lot of time, however, going through some of the things that a a fiduciary should think about before including in, say, a target date fund or other fund, a private equity sleeve. And that includes things like thinking about the different regulatory structures that might apply to private equity, making sure that the fund overall has sufficient liquidity to meet participants' needs if they, you know, need to change investments or take loans or distributions. It encourages fiduciaries to think about whether they need to have the help of an expert to oversee the private equity. And it also encourages plan fiduciaries to think about whether it's appropriate to have a maximum percentage that the fund can invest in private equity. And it even cites an existing SEC rule with a 15% maximum percentage for mutual funds that invest in illiquid assets. I think this information letter is going to be viewed as helpful to plan fiduciaries and their consultants who think that having a sleeve of private equity makes sense, particularly as we have fewer and fewer publicly traded firms that are accessible without going into the private equity market. On the other hand, I think fiduciaries may look at the information letter and say, gee, there's a lot we have to do here. And unless we're comfortable that we can sort of think through all the issues that the Department of Labor has told us, we're not going to move forward. Target date funds are obviously an incredibly important part of the retirement system. They're really the only investment type that continues to have more money going in than coming out pretty much under any market conditions. In part, that's because of automatic enrollment. And the target date fund industry has been looking at private equity for a long time. This gives the Department of Labor's sort of views on what you might consider if you were going to include private equity in the sleeve.
And they're very clear about the information letter only addresses the use of private equity in some sort of professionally managed or professionally constructed solution, not as a standalone option. The information letter was, I think, particularly clear. They weren't talking about that.
That's right. And there are some securities law limitations on using private equity outside of that circumstance. There are some plans that offer private equity inside a brokerage window or private equity-like investments through a brokerage window. But in general, I think that's pretty rare. And part of that is because you generally want to design your plan to make sense for most of your participants. And for most participants, they just wouldn't have the ability to sort of oversee, manage, and understand a direct investment in private equity.
I think for many plans, it's not just private equity. And in fact, a couple of firms have already talked about that while the letter addresses is a response to a very specific question about private equity, the steps that the DOL talked about, the considerations that they talked about would apply to a broader set of illiquid assets, things like real estate or infrastructure, in addition to traditional private equity.
I think that's right, and I think you're hitting on an important point we're beginning to see. As people move more into target date funds and similar asset allocation vehicles inside their 401k plan, and really you're sort of having one person go back and managing all their assets for them, it's becoming increasingly important to make sure that the target date fund or similar investment really makes sure you have exposure to all the asset classes that you need. And as we begin to think more about, you know, how should we change our thinking for different asset classes, especially as the public market has shrunk? I think you're going to see interest in those sorts of other asset classes in target date funds.
So because that's not enough stuff out of the DOL, we had one more come out just here in the last few days that's really on the back of the SECURE Act. The SECURE Act created sort of structurally this idea for multiple employer plans or pooled employer plans. And the DOL has now issued a request for information regarding prohibited transaction relief or exemptions with respect to PEPs. Now that implies that they're going to collect the information and then issue some sort of guidance subsequent to response to their request for information. Again, a little bit of background. What caused this RFI? What do we think the process is from here on MEPs and PEPs?
So as you say, Drew, the SECURE Act for the first time allowed providers to put together what are called an open multiple employer plan, open MEP, or pooled employer plan. Or PEP. And the idea there is you put together a plan structure where unrelated employers can join together in a single plan, and you get economies of scale, and you save on some regulatory costs. And one of the issues that came up almost immediately after that was passed is, okay, so if we're going to do that, who might offer those to the marketplace? And might they be folks who want to use proprietary or similar investments? The problem with that is that if you are both a plan fiduciary and you use your own investments, or you might be a plan fiduciary and you're hiring service providers that are kind of related to you, that can create what we call a prohibited transaction. Now, the Department of Labor is empowered to offer exemptions for prohibited transactions. Where there's a conflict, they can say, that's okay. You can move forward if you follow X, Y, and Z conditions. And for a PEP or a MEP structure, if you're going to make it successful, one of the things you might see is essentially investment companies offering these to the marketplace. And so the Department of Labor struggled from the very beginning of the passage of the SECURE Act to understand to the extent to which they might need to provide some exemptions, provide some a framework for different types of entities to offer these new plan structures, because they want them to be successful and they want them to actually lower cost. So what this RFI is really doing is saying to sort of the entire world, we've gotten some information, but we'd like everyone to have a chance to kind of weigh in on whether or not how providers will be putting together these PEPs, and if so, are you using a structure that requires an exemption? Now, I think many players in the marketplace are working very hard on this. Some of them may want to keep it somewhat close to the vest as the extent to which they're going to put their structure together and whether they'll have proprietary investments. But it does say to us that going forward, DOL is trying to, as quickly as they can, get MEPs and PEPs up and running. The SECURE Act makes them available starting in 2021, and DOL has a bunch of things they've got to do in order to stand them up, not just considering a prohibited transaction exemption, but also allowing the folks that are running these MEPs, called pool plan providers, there has to be a registration process for them. That has to be up and running by the end of the year. A lot for DOL to do in a short period of time.
So maybe we could wrap up here by just a little bit of legislative prognosticating on your part. What do we think we might or might not see in the remainder of calendar 2020 with respect to retirement plan legislation?
So we're getting kind of into what we think of as the silly season, meaning the run-up to the presidential election. And that Congress does tend to slow down, do only the minimum, and not really do much that's controversial. Now, there is a difference of opinion between the House and the Senate as to what is needed, if anything, in further response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The House passed on May 15th a bill called the HEROES Act, which the headline for it is provides a lot of funding to state and local governments, up to $3 trillion. But it also includes some other things that might be viewed as sort of cleanup from the CARES Act, including this, and this is probably most relevant to advisors. As you know, the CARES Act waived your required minimum distributions for 2020. The HEROES Act would actually waive them for 2019 and give folks until almost the end of this year to repay their 2019 and 2020 RMDs if they took them. That's a fairly big deal. The HEROES Act would also provide funding relief for defined benefit plans, both single employer and multi-employer, and provide some cleanup on some technical issues related to the CARES Act. Now, the Senate is not interested in passing that bill as is. They're not going to spend $3 trillion. They are working on probably a smaller package, which we might not see until July. It could be pushed into August, maybe September. Republicans, in general, want to take a wait-and-see approach. Now, we've talked about, Drew, lots of other retirement ideas, including what's sometimes called Secure 2.0, the next package of retirement ideas that sort of builds on the SECURE Act. We had expected the House to make some progress on that next retirement bill this summer, probably with hearings, maybe even a markup, although we weren't expecting it to become law this year. The COVID-19 pandemic has really focused folks on other things. And so I don't think it's likely that, I never thought it was likely we'd see the next big retirement bill this year. I did think it was likely the House would make more progress, and I still think they'd like to do that. But the COVID-19 and the need to do other things has certainly pushed back the agenda. They are still working on it. I think our next big retirement bill is going to have to wait until after the election, until the parties can see who's in charge of what do we need to do on a bipartisan basis, and what can be pushed through on its own.
I think that's enough for all of us to consider. Thank you, Michael, as always, for your insights on all the changes that are going on in Washington, and thank you all for listening.
This material reflects the analysis and opinions of the speakers as of June 18, 2020, and may differ from the opinions of other portfolio managers, investment teams, or platforms at Franklin Templeton. The views expressed are those of the speakers, and the comments, opinions, and analyses are rendered as of the date of this podcast and may change without notice. The information provided in this material is not intended as a complete analysis of every material fact regarding any country, region, market, industry, security, or strategy. Statements of fact are from sources considered reliable, but no representation or warranty is made as to their completeness or accuracy. This communication is general in nature and provided for educational and informational purposes only. It should not be considered or relied upon as legal, tax, or investment advice, or an investment recommendation, or as a substitute for legal or tax counsel. Any investment products or services named herein are for illustrative purposes only and should not be considered an offer to buy or sell, or an investment recommendation for any specific security strategy or investment product or service. Always consult a qualified professional or your own independent financial professional for personalized advice or investment recommendations tailored to your specific goals, individual situation, and risk tolerance. Franklin Templeton, FT, does not provide legal or tax advice. Federal and state laws and regulations are complex and subject to change, which can materially impact your results. FT cannot guarantee that such information is accurate, complete, or timely, and disclaims any liability arising out of your use of or any tax position taken in reliance on such information. All financial decisions and investments involve risk, including possible loss of principal. Data from third-party sources may have been used in the preparation of this material, and FT has not independently verified, validated, or audited such data. FT accepts no liability whatsoever for any loss arising from use of this information, and reliance upon the comments, opinions, and analyses in the material is at the sole discretion of the user. Products, services, and information may not be available in all jurisdictions and are offered outside the U.S., by other FT affiliates and or their distributors as local laws and regulation permits. Please consult your own financial professional for further information on availability of products and services in your jurisdiction. Issued in the U.S. by Franklin Templeton Distributors, Inc., the principal distributor of Franklin Templeton's U.S. registered products, which are available only in jurisdictions where an offer or solicitation of such products is permitted under applicable laws and regulation. Issued by Franklin Templeton outside of the U.S., please visit www.franklinresources.com to be directed to your local Franklin Templeton website. Copyright 2020 Franklin Templeton, all rights reserved.